to. This radio show is going to be sexual assault in the military, and one of our guests today will be Al Tlusty, also a member of Chapter 92.
Hello, everyone. This is Michael McPherson. I really want to thank you for listening. I also want to remind you that you can hear us streaming each fourth Wednesday of the month at kodxseattle.org, and you can also find our past episodes there. But before we talk to Al, our first guest is Lori Manning. She's a retired captain of the United States Navy. She's director of government operations for Service Women's Action Network. We're really excited to have her here on the show today.
Yeah, welcome, Lori.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, so Lori, you know, as you and I talked briefly before we started this interview, and I told you I Googled you, you Googled me too, because it's what we do these days, right? And I saw that you have been working to lower barriers and eliminate discrimination faced by service women for quite some time now. These barriers and discrimination simply because they're women. So can you tell us a little bit about your background, how you came to work on these issues, and how you got involved with Service Women's Action Network, which is also known as SWAN?
Sure, I'm glad to. Well, my first involvement with them was when I was like 9 years old and wanted to play Little League Baseball because I was really good. And in those days, no girls allowed. I had four brothers, they all got to do that. And we were raised Catholic and they all got to be altar boys. And I never thought it was fair that I couldn't be one of those too.
Right.
Then I joined the Navy. And at that time, which was early 70s sort of time frame, the women's liberation movement was really just kicking off in the United States. And it was against the law. It wasn't just not done, but it was against the law for women to serve aboard a Navy ship other than a hospital ship, for women to fly in an airplane that could have a combat mission. And then many, many, many other things were closed to women by policy. Those of you who were Vietnam era know that very few women who weren't nurses were sent to Vietnam, very different than what we see now with Iraq and Afghanistan. And one of the interesting things about that is there were very few men in the military nurse corps back then. Mm. The Navy's just opened to men in 1965. So there was things in those days were very much channeled by whether you were a male or a female, much more so than they are now.
Right.
And I, one of the jobs I had in the Navy involved deciding what jobs women could go to or not. And I became pretty fierce when I was fighting some of those battles because mostly because of the silly reasons that I was given why a woman couldn't do something.
Can you give it as an example?
Oh, sure. Well, let me tell you one story from my own career. I was assigned on the island of Diego Garcia, which is a small island out in the middle of the Indian Ocean. Mm-hmm. And I ran all the communications for the Indian Ocean for the U.S. Navy and various other people sometimes. And one of my jobs was to fly out to Navy aircraft carriers when they came into the Indian Ocean and talk over with the people on the ship what sort of support they needed from us. And my predecessor was male, my successor was male. They would go out for 2 or 3 days, but because I was a woman, I was not allowed to spend the night on a Navy ship. So I would have to fly 5 hours usually to Diego Garcia, from Diego Garcia to the ship, which was usually up in the Arabian Sea, and then turn around and fly home that night. And I always had to have a place to what they called to bingo, to hop, to do something that a helicopter could do. If by chance the longer legged planes couldn't launch from the carrier, they needed to be able to helicopter me to someplace where I could spend the night.
Wow.
But while I was out there, we had the Dallas football cheerleaders came for a USO show at Christmas time. They were all allowed to spend two nights aboard the aircraft carrier because they weren't in the Navy. So the law didn't apply to them. I mean, it was that kind of stupid stuff that you encountered sometimes.
Wow, it's absurd.
And they certainly weren't in uniform.
Not in a Navy uniform.
No, the Dallas cheerleaders.
They were in their uniform. Yeah.
I will say when they were on Diego Garcia, there's no hotels or anything on Diego Garcia. So one of them stayed in the place where I was staying because there were two places to sleep there. And that was the one time that every guy that worked for me, and there were over 300 of them, decided he needed to come see me about something.
Yeah.
But she was very good, good about that.
Right. So how long did you serve?
25 years.
25 years. And just for the audience, when we say that you're a captain in the Navy, that's the equivalent of being a colonel in the U.S. Army. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
That's right. So you retired at the level of what people would, I just want people to know what that means. It's different than I was a captain in the United States Army, and that's definitely different than being a captain in the Navy. So after you retired, and at some point you got involved with SWAN.
Right. In between those two things, I worked for an organization called the Women's Research and Education Institute. Mm-hmm. And they had a project that was funded by the Ford Foundation that worked on getting the laws changed and the policies changed on women in the military, and opening more jobs to them. And I did that for a while. And then eventually the RISE is what it was called. It was mostly a bunch of baby boomers, and most of them wanted to retire. I wasn't quite ready for that yet. So RIE closed down, and then I moved over to the Service Women's Action Network at that point, which was about 5 years ago.
Okay, okay. So tell us a little bit about SWAN.
Well, SWAN was started by two women who served in the Marine Corps back in 2008. One was a captain when she got out, and so was, I think the other one was also. And they were joined by another, you're not allowed to say ex-Marine, I guess, because once you're a Marine, you're always a Marine. But
right. Marine veteran.
Yeah, another Marine veteran. And he had been an infantry officer and had taught some women at Quantico when they were going through. And he also thought the Marines could get a lot more... could train these women to do so much more than they were allowing them to do.
Right.
And they had all met up at Quantico at some point, and so he joined them after they founded it. And we've been around ever since, mostly working on sexual assault and opening of things that used to be closed to women. Giving everybody who can do a job the chance to try and do it.
So the biggest reason we're having this interview is to talk about sexual assault, which you briefly brought up. And Veterans for Peace has been concerned about sexual assault in the military for quite some time. I know, for example, in 2007 convention, which was in St. Louis, Missouri, I did it was organized by Ann Wright and some other members of Colonel Ann Wright, who you know. Organized by her and some other the members, but I participated in a press conference to talk about sexual assault in the military. And part of that, I think, came from a little more highlighting of it in the news, because there were reports of women who were not drinking in Iraq. They were not drinking water during the daytime, and they were becoming dehydrated, and some of them died as a result of that. And so that it came out in the news. And at the time we were saying that like one in three women were being impacted by sexual assault in the military. Now, I'm not sure if we were correct in that. So I think that there's more attention being paid to it today. So I was wondering if you could give us like an overview of what's happening on that issue and where we are today.
The military never spent much time at all thinking about it, even though it was probably going on in World War II when the WACs and those were serving. And it's also not something that just happens to women, just because of the numbers. More men are sexually assaulted in the military than women. A higher percentage of women are.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's often done for hazing. Somebody whose his comrades don't think he's carrying his weight, or with respect to men, there's also a very interesting study that the RAND Corporation put out 2 months ago, saying that gay men are very frequently raped by straight men for who knows what reason. I think almost 42% of all sexual assaults in the military these days are done to minorities, sexual minorities, racial and ethnic minorities, and of course, straight white women. Not counting the straight white women. So they're over 50% of it, but it's sexual minorities are targets of sexual assault. And when the military talks about sexual assault, they don't just mean rape. They mean any unwanted touching. So it's not that all these people have been raped, but it's that they were subjected to some pretty horrible things that were done because of who they are. Mm-hmm. Now, most people know, and then the military has been having all sorts of investigations and studies and reports, at least since the Taylor days, so for more than 30 years now. But
would you say at least since when?
1991, when the Navy's Tailhook scandal happened.
Oh, Tailhook, right. Yeah. Right, I remember, yes.
That was 30 years ago. People who weren't born are in the military now. And the sexual assault statistics haven't budged a bit. In fact, they've gone up a little bit since those days. And the military has done a lot. They are doing a much better job, although not a great job, of taking care of people who are sexually assaulted. Both while they're still on active duty and later within the Veterans Affairs Administration, although they probably don't have enough counselors and treatment facilities for some of the veterans who were sexually assaulted. Mm-hmm. They've also made many, many changes to the Uniform Code of Military Justice that have helped making it, for instance, in the military, as you both know, or any veteran knows, the unit commander decides if any crime, anything from petty theft through a murder, gets investigated. And then he or she also gets to decide after the investigation whether to do anything about it. Mm-hmm. Even if there's a court martial and the person is found guilty, that person who may be very junior and very few of whom have had any legal training would make the decision over to whether overturn a jail sentence. And they had that power, which brings back from the old days in World War II, where you couldn't just pick up the phone and call somebody and ask for help or have a lawyer, come in to wherever you happened to be during the war. It might've been necessary back then, but it sure isn't now. Right. And the military has so many more lawyers than it did back in World War II, or even the 60s and 70s. The other problem is that the crime itself is bad, but a lot of the people who report it find themselves retaliated against. Their colleagues, their fellow soldiers and sailors, their peers in the unit will blame them. And we'll tell them, hey, you're going to ruin this guy's career. He's got a wife. He's got three kids. He's going to get a dishonorable discharge, and it's all your fault. Mm-hmm. A lot of the more senior leadership in the services think, well, that's, you know, that sex, you know, their job is to win wars and, you know, what are they, what do some people say, break things and kill people, so to speak, which is obscene. And that, you know, we can't be bothered having to take some of our best soldiers and sailors and kick them out because, you know, they got drunk or some girl is lying about them. They just didn't give it the attention it needed.
Right.
Now, President Biden, when he came in January, ordered yet another study, the called the Independent Review Commission. And it's very much supported by the Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin. And in fact, what he has done, which is I've never seen done before, is there are many groups that work on military sexual assault, but he invited five of us to come and talk to him. The invitation went out the day after he was sworn into office.
Okay.
And we have had Zoom meetings with him three times now to talk about when he decided to set up the Independent Review Commission, and the most recent one was to look at the recommendations and how to go about putting them into place. And what he is doing now, along with his deputy, Kathleen Hicks, is not putting this report on the shelf. I mean, all the other reports made recommendations and then nothing ever happened. This one, he has put his deputy, Secretary of Defense, in charge of coming up with a plan to actually implement these recommendations. Some of which, if this report is online, anybody who wants to read it can go to the Secretary of Defense website and look at it, download it, whatever. And some of the recommendations in there, if, that's a big if, will actually help. The one that I think is most important is that they want to develop a way to hold unit leaders, and not just the colonels and the captains, but down to the lower level, to the senior NCOs and the young lieutenants and captains who are actually the platoon leaders, to teach them how to build a cohesive unit so that there aren't insiders and outsiders, so that everybody is part of the group, everybody knows their job, has a role to play, and they support each other. You know, I certainly wouldn't, if I had sexually assaulted somebody, I wouldn't want them to be the person that the person I assaulted to have my back in combat, for instance.
Right. Right.
So they want to put the emphasis on yes, you got to do your unit mission, but you can't do your unit mission without this unit cohesiveness. And in fact, I mean, it's the story of every war movie I've ever seen, taking a diverse group of people and the 40-year-old sergeant and the green lieutenant somehow build a working unit out of them. And that's, they want to bring that back into something that, I mean, it's always supposed to be there, but nobody's paying attention to it. So to change the way they build leaders, to value, to understand why you need a cohesive unit where everybody is valued, nobody is the outsider. Mm. We'll see. That's where we are now. Secretary Hicks, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, has a working group, and she's got 2 months to come up with an implementation plan. Congress also has these recommendations because some of them, particularly one that involves taking all sexual assault accusations out of the commander's hands and putting them into a specially trained prosecutor. That requires congressional authority, and they'll be looking at that. They're putting together their next round of what they call the National Defense Authorization Act for 2022 right now. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that they are looking at, and maybe we'll see some changes in the law coming from that. There is also, there are two bills in Congress right now, one on each side, one Senate, one House, called the Military Justice Improvement and Change Act. It's a Military Justice Improvement and Increasing Prevention Act. It has a new name. Mm-hmm. That Senator Gillibrand from New York has been championing for a long time.
Right.
That act, for the first time, actually got through the Senate Armed Services Committee, and it's going to be debated in the House Armed Services Committee this week. And then if it gets through those, it'll be part of the National Defense Authorization Act that gets debated in September when the full House and full Senate will look at it. So those are separate from the commission that just finished reporting. And that act does something that the commission recommendation doesn't. It takes not only things like sexual assault, sexual harassment away from the commander. This law will also take all felony crimes that aren't strictly military away from the commander. Things like murder, armed robbery, kidnapping. It will leave things like desertion or misbehavior before the enemy or disobedience of an order. Those will stay with the commander. Those are discipline. But felony crimes are not unit discipline things. You know, if I'm a parent, of a 15-year-old, I get to discipline him or her. But if they steal a car for a joyride, right, I no longer am in charge of it. And it, that's the same idea for this. So
Those are the
things that are going on right now. And we'll have to see over the next 3 or 4 months if any of them become the law, and if Secretary Lloyd and his team is able to change the idea of what leadership ought to mean in the military.
Right, right. Mike?
Well, thank you for those remarks. I know that last time I'm not that familiar with UCMJ, but UCMJ, I think, clearly states that sexual touching or harassments and assaults, to say the least, are illegal, a criminal act under UCMJ, and that's been that way for many, many, many decades. The fact that the UCMJ hasn't been upheld and prosecuted says something about the military leadership. Of course, that's what you've been talking about. Mm-hmm. The Gillibrand's bill will actually remove the authority out of the commanders, because often, the sexual people who are involved in sexual assault are the commanders, and which is a problem for somebody. Also, Western European militaries have debunked this sort of thing about the commander's authority, says they don't have any problem with actually moving this sort of legal process out of the commander's jurisdiction. Could you comment? I mean, that's the argument against it, that it's the commander's loss of authority.
That is what they're saying to this day, is that if the commander doesn't keep those authorities, he'll lose control of his unit. And I've been a commander. That's baloney.
Yes.
You know, I didn't make medical decisions about my people. I didn't decide so-and-so needs an appendectomy, because I don't have the training for that. Right. And it's the same thing in my book. If somebody is accused of that, you may lose them. But if somebody has a medical situation, you can't decide you're not going to treat his appendectomy or his cancer or whatever just because he's the only guy that can fix the empty squat on your base. They've got to let go of that. And it gets back to that they're responsible for the discipline, but not for the felonies. There have been some changes. The UCMJ has been around since 1948. And one of the more recent changes to the Act on Sexual Assault, was called just rape until fairly recently, was that a standard of proof that you had to prove that the person who was assaulted resisted the assault, which made it really difficult, because what does that even mean? Does that mean she said no? No, you had to prove that she physically resisted, or he physically resisted. And they're looking for blood and broken bones when something like that happens. Some people are so scared they can't even, you know, they're paralyzed with fear.
Right.
So there have been changes to the UCMJ that have made it better, but it's still not good.
Right, right.
Just one other comment. I've talked about this issue with a former chapter member. She's also an Army captain, mm-hmm. and a pastor. She was actually a pastor. Now she was a chaplain. But we talked about this as an issue of military discipline and patriotism, really. And it's her opinion. She's a very very smart person, really. She said it's a matter, she says, that sort of thing, in her opinion, is just treason. For a soldier to assault another soldier, considering that the government considers soldiers as government property, that is treason, you know, and should be treated as such. It's a interesting sort of concept, but she spent 10 years in the military as an officer. I was an E5 a long time ago in Vietnam, but my understanding of the military hierarchy is that if you've got a commander who says that there will be no sexual assault, talking about, say, a company commander, somebody who commands 200 people or so, that it wouldn't happen. You tell your lieutenants, your captains, other captains, and your sergeants, and says, I will start court-martialing and giving Article 15s and boot you out of my command if you do that sort of thing. That clearly hasn't happened.
No, there are some leaders like that, but it hasn't happened, but there aren't enough of them by far. She's right. And she's right, it is a form of treason. What a military unit needs is trust between its members. You have to be able to trust people, and you can't trust somebody that has sexually assaulted you, nor should the sort of person who assaults their comrades be allowed to stay in that unit. They need to be gone. They need to be in jail.
Right.
Mind if it was treason.
So we just have a few more minutes. Could you tell us what you think or what people who are listening, I should say, people who are listening to this program, what can they do to help this legislation move forward? What can we do to put pressure on the military to carry out the recommendations? You know, what are the next steps?
The next steps would be for anybody who cares about this to call their senators and their representatives and tell them. You can call them, you can email them, you can call the local district office or state office, or you can call their DC offices. They really do tally up the calls they get on things. Tell them to pass the Military Justice Improvement Act this year. They could do that as a standalone act, or they could just make it part of the Authorization Act for 2022. Mm-hmm. That's what I would do, is call and tell them that. And the support for this is bipartisan. This is one of the very few things that doesn't really break along Republican and Democratic lines. Not that anybody will tell you that they're for sexual assault, but for taking that authority away from commanders, there's pretty good congressional support for it. So find out who your senators are, find out who your representative is, call them and tell them to support that. That would be, I think, the very best thing you can do, because it's before them right now. They are looking at it right now, and will be looking at it as a full Congress and a House. And right now it's the committees that deal with it, but the full Senate and House will be looking at it in September.
Okay.
As you may be pleased to know that in our last chapter meeting in 92, which was Saturday, the chapter voted to support Gillibrand's bill and send a note to her indicating the chapter 92, we're going to support it and put our name with those other supporters, including a lot of veteran service organizations, incidentally. I don't know if the DAV and the American Legion support this, but some of the other service organizations do support it.
Yeah, I think DAV does. So do Vietnam Vets. I've worked with them.
Vietnam Veterans, yeah.
Vietnam Veterans does. And so does Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans. Yeah. I'm working on some of the others. Maybe they'll come around.
Good, good. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. This is really great information and a really important topic.
Thank you for asking me, and please call get that legislation passed.
Thank you, Lori.
Yes, thanks for doing this show. I think it's important for your members to have access to this, or I guess anybody can listen to it. So thanks for doing it. I think it's a really good thing.
Cool. All right.
My name is Alan Telesti. I went into the service when I was 17, right out of high school, from 67 to 69. After basic training in AIT, I was sent right away to Vietnam. I just turned 18, so I was one of the kids that was sent by our military. But anyway, my first assignment was when I asked around, they said, I had no idea where I was when I got to Vietnam. And so I asked around, it's like, you know, who are we? Who am I with? And they were saying that we were with the 196th and 198th Light Infantry Brigade out of North Carolina. And because of my size, I just sort of got singled out. There was about eight of us, one Australian soldier, Dive Holly. He was 23. He was the oldest amongst us. But anyway, we trained as tunnel rats for like 5 weeks. But right during that, near the end of that 5 week period, I was sexually assaulted. We took care of the situation. The guy was fragged. They pulled me off the unit, me and one of my buddies that I trained with. We had to go through a court martial. Leading up to that, you know, I didn't know if I was facing murder charges or, you know, whether it was going to be a sexual assault situation. As it turned out, during the questioning, it was all about the sexual assault. Nothing was said about the fragging, which was a great relief to me because I was thinking about spending time at Fort Leavenworth, you know, and I just turned 18, and, you know, that was just not a good thing. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I got reassigned to the 9th Infantry Division after that. I just served out the rest of my time in Vietnam. I went about 45 years without saying anything. The sexual assault plus my other military experience, I got shot down a couple of times, and there's four times when I had to hold people at gunpoint, hostages, and then I went through the Tet Offensive. So my military experience, 67, 68, it all got thrown into one basket, and I didn't say anything about it or talk about it. And 45 years later, about 10 years ago, it just imploded on me, and I was going down the suicide path, and it was... I have a great support group, and a lot of friends look out for me, and, you know, they would always offer their help and say, you know, Al, if you want to talk about it, or if you need help, you know, just contact us. But I didn't know how to do that. But the suicide just got to be too much, because I was walking around for days, just, and it wouldn't leave me. And I know myself well enough to know that I'm not that kind of person. So anyway, I checked in and went through 2 days of suicide screening, and at first, their recommendation was they'd give me some opioids. And I said, you know, I don't even have aspirin in my medicine cabinet. What are you doing throwing drugs at me? You know, and I hear about enough veterans who, you know, are having problems. And you know, you're throwing opioids at them. And then the next thing you know, you got a heroin addict on your hands. And so just that's the wrong thing to be talking to me about. Anyway, I went through 6 years of PTSD and military sexual assault counseling. I was with Wounded Warriors for 3 years, which really helped because with the Wounded Warriors, I was with some combat experienced veterans, and it was easy to talk with them. We just knew what each other were saying. But anyway, I went through the PTSD therapy about a year ago. I was on outpatient therapy, and at that point, there were still under observation. If things worked out okay, I was having like 4 or 5 nightmares, flashback nightmares a year. One or two of them was with my sexual assault, and I still have those. I have 1 to 2 a year about nightmares about my sexual assault. My combat experience that sort of faded away. It's been about 2-3 years. Nightmares, there's times when I'd sleepwalk, or I'd get up and set up ambushes in the house just because something tripped me off, and I'd get scared. I don't know how long I was gone. I still have problems with sometimes when I watch TV and I see shootings, I black out because of my experience with shootings, civilians. But that's an ongoing thing. I can accept that. And because of the therapy, I think the VA did a good job of my therapist working with me, where I was able to like categorize and put into the compartments, you know, what was coming at me when I'm going through these experiences. But the sexual assault, that was a hard one. I can't talk to guys about it because they don't get it. And I frequently hear from women, wives, that you know, they don't know how their husbands won't open up and don't talk about their emotions, and you know, and I think, you know, that's how we were brought up. I know I was in my household, where, you know, I had to be a tough guy and not talk about feelings, and you know, if something bothered me, you know, wipe it off and move on, and you know, forget about what had happened. But again, it got to be too much, the first that I opened up with was a couple of women who had been molested, raped, and one was her dad was a ranger, Green Beret, and he molested her as she grew up. But that was my first opening about 6-7 years ago. Was just I just sort of threw out that some joke or being sarcastic about sexual assault. And the person we were on the same pool team, and she opened up. She said, "Yeah, I can relate to you what you're saying." And then suddenly with her, and then just more. But anyway, that was the first opening I had, was with females. And I live with it every day. I guess that is where my interest, or not my interest, that's the wrong word to use, but that's where my involvement with it becomes. I'm also with the King County Sexual Assault Group. I'm on their newsletter, and you know, we're just trying to do something about bringing awareness to the public, and I think that is what needs to happen with the military. Is that I think for the most part the civilian world is totally unaware of what's happening in the military with sexual assault and rape and the felonies, the crime that's going on, and I think that's where I think I come in, and that's my role, is to get the information out there, educate the public, let them know what the heck is going on with the military, you know, and even from the military standpoint, they need to worry about it too, because you know, it's tearing apart our ranks. You know, our combat readiness could be totally not there when we need them because of the sexual assault and rape problem within the military. But
that's Al, we went and we had a chapter meeting a few days back, and we were talking about the Christian Gillibrand's bill, which is now pending. Apparently, mm-hmm. Reed has come around, the opposition. So I think it's going to go to the Senate.
They have 60. The House. Yeah, they have 68 senators that have signed on, and I don't understand why Schumer or I don't understand why they aren't bringing it to the floor for a vote. You know, it's there. And then also Adam Smith down here in Auburn area, him and Turner, Republican from Ohio, they're replicating the same in Congress. They're replicating the same type of legislation, and they want to bring that, get enough support and write legislation for that too. So I think and Austin and Biden and you got the 68 senators, you've got people in Congress. There's a Austin, you know, Secretary, a lot of support. There's a lot of support for that. And essentially what it is, they want to take the prosecution out of the chain of command because like 2016, 2018, they reported like 16,000, 12,000, 16,000 cases of sexual assault. They wanted to, in 2020, the military came out and said, yeah, there's about 6,800 reported cases. The RAND Corporation did their own study and said, no, there's about 20,000. We're hitting right around 20,000 cases a year. And part what that brings up, or a consequence to the sexual assault in the military is that there's like 135,000, 137,000, mostly women. 1 in 12 women in the military get assaulted, and 1 in 5 males get assaulted. But anyway, what happens, especially with the women, is when they start complaining, their officers start harassing them and make it hard for them to, you know, just conduct their everyday life. And there's about 135,000, 137,000 men and women that have quit the military or have been released from the military, and they have dishonorable discharges. And that shouldn't be. I mean, more than likely it's no fault of their own, but it's just something that happened within the chain of command or in their unit, where they just got pushed out and targeted, and the consequence of that is they're ineligible for VA benefits, let alone if they go apply for a job and the employer says, hey, do you got your DD-214 or do you got military papers? You know, they could lie and say, no, I wasn't in the military, or yes, and if they say and are honest and say, yes, I was in the military, but I got dishonorably discharged, they aren't going to get the job.
Right.
And it's creating a huge, huge problem.
But Alan, this is Michael, and thank you for being on the show. The injustice of the idea that you could be sexually assaulted and then put out of the military with a less than honorable discharge, and how that impacts your life. You've already been assaulted, and that's impacting your life, as you talked about.
Absolutely.
Vietnam, we're talking 50 years ago. And then, so we have people out there right now who were impacted in that way and then had to be doubly impacted by being put out. But I wanted to real quickly just give the audience a few statistics. I'm looking at a fact sheet from Defend Our Defenders. I think that's the name of the group. They're a group that works to end sexual assault, but other forms of discrimination as well. So they said in fiscal year 2018, there were 20,500 service members who were sexually assaulted or raped, including 13,000 women and 7,500 men. And I know most of the time when people hear about sexual assault, they think about women. But we wanted to make clear it's not just women who are targeted. They go on to say the rate of sexual assault and rape jumped by 40% from fiscal years 2016 to 18. And for women, the rate increased by over 50% to the highest level since 2006. Of women who reported a penetrative sexual assault, 59% were assaulted by someone with a higher rank than them, and 24% were assaulted by someone in their chain of command. Yeah. And then the last stat I want to give is the vast majority of cases go unreported. 76.1% of victims did not report the crime in fiscal year 2018. Yeah. So I just wanted people to know these things.
Because they're throwing out the number that there's probably like 30, 35,000 actual cases of sexual assault. But like you're saying, Michael, is that a lot of them don't get reported because the folks want to stay in the military. And if they report it, well, then there's the retaliation. Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of shame involved as well. So one thing you mentioned earlier is when you got to Vietnam, you believe you were singled out because of your size.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. and tell me if I'm wrong here. I'm 5'7". I weigh like 140 pounds, maybe 145. As men go, that's a small, I'm a small man. That's what I call myself. And I know that as a small man growing up as a kid and up to now, there's challenges or ways that people like to treat us. You know, there's certain things we have to navigate. So I'm wondering if you feel like that when you said that, is that what you're talking about? And, you know, what role do you think that plays in the sexual assault in the military?
Yeah, I think it is a big part of it in that the predators that are there, the predators, they didn't become predators when they joined the military.
Mm-hmm.
It goes back into high school. They were probably the bullies, or you know, that when I was in high school, there was some years where the only place that I could hang out at lunchtime was in the principal's office, because you know the guys and I'll say for me the schools I went to, the guys that were the bullies were the football players. Mm. They were jerks, and I know that. Anyway, I probably shouldn't categorize, but anyway, that's the truth. I mean, the guys, they tried to put me in, hang me up on hooks by my belt, stuff me in wall lockers, trash cans, getting pushed into trash cans. But again, it was the football players, and they were the jerks in the schools that I went to.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that a lot of the football teams, they have that problem within their organizations. They got the predators, they got the sex offenders, they got the wife beaters. And then I wrestled. I went to University of Oregon. I wrestled it, and I hung out with the athletes. I tended to hang out with track people because of our demeanors, pretty much the same. We're calm and quiet.
Mm-hmm. I ran track, so I can attest to that being true. Some truth to that.
Yeah, and so we'd go to parties, and we'd be there for a while, and then suddenly, you know, the rumor would come in: "Hey, some of the football players are on the way, man." You know, we'd leave. I didn't want to be around those people. You know, some of them would be coming, you know, I don't know if they're on steroids, or I know they were drinking, but, you know, "Hey, man, I just put my head through a windshield," you know, that kind of stuff, man. It's sort of like, I can't, good for you. You know, but anyway, I think it's just an ongoing, I don't know if it's our culture or maybe it's other cultures that are having the same problem as sexual assault. But I think, you know, it's coming, there's a lack of foundation in the home, or, you know, it's coming from out of high school or grade school. It just doesn't start in the military. And right. I think that's one of the things the military needs to look at, is like do a better job of screening. And I would say also, I'll throw in, they need to do a better job of screening for white supremacists and neo-Nazis,
sure,
and that group of people too, because that just doesn't start when they get into the military. I mean, that's coming out of somewhere else.
That's part of the problem. Like you say, you know, sexual assaults are carryovers from the civilian population. But the military is one of the few organizations as an extremely hierarchical institution that could do something about this, and unlike most civilian
mm-hmm.
situations, but they haven't.
Exactly.
I wanted to tell you something, because Alan, when you were talking about the high school experience and that they came into the military as predators or as bullies or whatever. So I was looking at RAIN, which is an organization that also fights sexual assault, RAINN, and they have some statistics. So they are saying everyone is affected by sexual violence. Every 68 seconds, another American is sexually assaulted.
Yeah.
One out of every six American women has been the victim of an attempted or completed rape in her lifetime. 14.8% completed, 2.8% attempted. About 3% of American men, or 1 in 33, have experienced or attempted or completed rape in their lifetime. That's terrible. And the this one from 2009 to 2013, Child Protective Service Agency substantiated or found strong evidence to indicate that 63,000 children a year were victims of sexual abuse. So we basically have a crisis in our society.
Yeah.
When it comes to sexual assault, rape, and then you go into an environment like the military, which is all about domination. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the whole point of the military, is to dominate a group. So they teach you how to do that and create that a stronger mentality for that. So I wonder if it's even possible to control it. And I hear what Mike's saying, because it is hierarchical. But you got these tensions of teaching domination, a society that allows rampant domination of women, of targeted people. And then that institution is also going to say, but don't do that to those same people that's supposed to be your battle buddies. Ooh, that's a hard, you know, that's a hard thing. I don't know. What do you all think?
Well, I think that, you know, and I've talked about this with you before.
Yeah.
I think we need to hold the military accountable for the people that they're in charge of.
Yeah.
And there's clearly was actually Lori mentioned something about the United States Uniform Code of Military Justice. They recently changed the criteria for reporting sexual assaults to proof of sexual assault, including you have to have proof that you were touched, witnesses, mm-hmm. that sort of thing, which would be very difficult. Usually those things happen in isolation. And from 1948, when the UCMJ was started, to now, a fairly recent provision is it makes it even harder for people to prove that they were sexually assaulted.
No.
That's not going forward.
No.
Yeah.
And I have a little bit of a write-in here from sexual assault study. But anyway, it talks about substantiating your case. And it says, the Navy says, it will always, this is talking about dishonorable discharges, it'll always presume that the discharge given to the soldier, the sailor, was correct, and that unhappy ex-sailors must produce, and here it is, clear and substantial evidence that the discharge was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I think feeding into what Mike says, so like, how do you do that?
Right.
My gosh.
Right.
So again, they got a lot of people just getting discharged with bad papers.
Right.
You know?
Right. That's true. And I totally agree with Mike. You got to hold people accountable. That's true. But accountability, that's wrong. I mean, to solve the problem, accountability plays a role, but there's something that's created the culture before the person has attempted to act. So what do we do to, we won't have to hold you accountable if you don't do it. You know, what do we do to make it so people don't do it? Part of it's accountability. We're saying that with the police. The police need to be held accountable. So yes, but there's something else has got to change too. Just like with the police, something else got to change, because I would prefer that you not kill anybody and then me hold you accountable for that. I want you to stop killing people, you know? So what do we need to do? And accountability is part of it, because they'll think twice before they pull the trigger. But there's something that's made them want to pull the trigger. So what is making these men, because it's mostly men doing it, yeah. doing it to men, doing it to women, not that no women do it, but it's vastly mostly men. And we don't, maybe we could try to wrap it up with this. What can we do to get us men under control? Because something is wrong.
Well, one of the things I think is that accountability is the big thing. And masculine culture in this country is a very toxic culture, generally speaking. And it's responsible for, specifically for these assaults against other men and women, you know, and it's that sort of, as far as the military goes specifically, there can be some accountability. And I think that would be an example, certainly as far as the police department goes too, that people are held accountability in a legal sense, and if necessary, punished for this.
Right.
But that is an example to say that you hold that sort of a process up to people who says, this is wrong. You're going to be punished for this sort of thing. And this is why it's wrong. Mm-hmm. And that will help to change the culture itself. It's a long term. I mean, there's a lot of problems with this country and that need changing, a correction and societal changes. And this is one, you know, the racism, endemic racism in this country, mm-hmm. sort of is another inequity, financial inequity.
Yeah.
And maybe one solution to the problem would be is if the service member could sue his assailant,
mm-hmm.
you know, but against, right now it's against law via the, I think it's Perez Act way back in 60s or 70s that government government people can't sue the government.
Mm.
I think change that.
Right.
I think that, you know, for those of us going into the service or for the parents, I think they want to know that their children are safe.
Yes.
You know, even when they go to college, and that's another area too, yeah. that I think colleges should, as far as in their resume of what they have to offer, they need to post or publish their sexual assault and rape statistic, mm-hmm. so the parents know what kind of school they're going to.
That's a good idea.
If it's safe.
Right.
Well, you know, following up on that, you know, Veterans for Peace does kind of recruiting in schools and talk to kids who are thinking about joining the military. One of the things we say to these things is, you know, it's called the armed forces for a reason. You're armed. You learn how to shoot weapons. And that for some of the statistics as far as sexual assault, this is certainly as far as women, but also men, clearly. That is just with something like a 30 to 40% sexual assault rate or more in the military, you should be advised of this, that this is a dangerous place to be. And also in addition, if you're gay or LGBT, to go into the military is not a safe place for you.
Yeah.
I'd make the argument that it's not safe for women, certainly.
Yeah, anybody. Well, I think we need to wrap it up.
I'd like to thank Al for sharing a story, a little more complete story than I've heard. It's not an easy thing to do, but thank you, Al, for this book.
Yeah, most
gotta
definitely.
Get it out there. You got to get it out there.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Al. All right. I want to thank our guest once again, Seattle Veterans for Peace chapter member and Vietnam War veteran, Alan Telesky, and Lori Manning, who is currently Director of Government Operations of the Service Women's Action Network, also known as SWAN. Lori is a retired U.S. Navy captain. Our music is from The Passion Hi-Fi at thepassionhifi.com. And until next time, power to the people.